You have 15 minutes. Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay, you can proceed whenever you're ready, sir.
May it please the court, my name is Brad Haywood for the appellant Andrew Schmuel. As the court is aware, the Court of Appeals granted 6 assignments of error in this case. All 6 more or less grew out of the first, I would say. The trial court's ruling that Stamper versus Commonwealth bars mental state evidence except in statutory insanity cases. It's our position that decision was an error. It adopts a narrow reading based on one conclusory sentence at the end of the analysis, while ignoring the broader context and rationale of the opinion. Just to briefly discuss that case, defendant and Stamper pled a diminished capacity defense. He alleged that because of serious mental illness, he could not form the intent to distribute narcotics. The holding in that case, the Stamper court found that the defendant was not permitted to go forward with his evidence because he was pursuing a defense that was not cognizable in Virginia, namely the diminished capacity defense. It's not a defense, of course, that Virginia acknowledges. The relevance, it ultimately became a relevance case. This was a relevance case. The decision was that in order for it to be relevant and admissible, it must bear on a fact and issue. And the facts of a diminished capacity defense can never be an issue because that defense doesn't exist.
Mr. Haywood, can I just ask you, because your time goes by so quickly here, you don't dispute that Virginia is a McNaughton state, right?
Is it what?
A McNaughton state.
That's correct.
So given that, and you cite to the Supreme Court's 1923 decision in Johnson, I believe, in your brief.
That's correct.
But in Stamper, in 1985, the Supreme Court specifically said, accordingly, we hold the evidence of a criminal defendant's mental state at the time of the offense is, in the absence of an insanity defense, irrelevant to the issue of guilt. The trial court committed no error in excluding it at the guilt phase of the trial. And you did, under the statute, initially indicate that you were going to put forward an insanity defense. But then, when the court proceeded to say, well, you know, there are other things that have to happen with that, such as the report that your expert did on Mr. Schmuel would have to be something that would be reviewable by the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth would get to appoint its own expert to, examine Mr. Schmuel. At that point, you moved to an involuntary intoxication defense, correct? And that you said insanity really was not your defense.
I never noticed an insanity defense. I provided notice to the trial court of a defense with an insanity standard. So, and that was what was discussed at 2 different motion states. Okay. And that was what was clarified at that time.
So just to follow up on that, and I'm just trying to understand your argument. If the Supreme Court has been very clear in Stamper, and you acknowledge McNaughton, if it's not an insanity defense, why isn't this just irrelevant? Why is this evidence that you're trying to put on essentially irrelevant, given the Supreme Court's very clear holding in Stamper?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I'm not sure it's that clear. And the reason is, I don't think you can ignore the broader context of the opinion and focus only on the conclusory sentence. That sentence comes at the end of a discussion of why courts in Virginia, or why Virginia doesn't acknowledge a defense of diminished capacity. States that that psychology essentially is too frequently revised, that it's a subject to subtle and shifting gradations, and that's not the business that the law should be in having a constantly shifting standard. And instead, it discusses
but why
this.
Wouldn't intoxication be subject to the same problems, that you get on a slippery slope? Maybe in this situation the person is greatly intoxicated, another one he's not. The question obviously would be, as you argue, of an involuntary intoxication because of what the doctors prescribed. But why don't, if the point is insanity defense or nothing as far as getting this information in before the court, why wouldn't the involuntary intoxication defense essentially be on the same slippery slope?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the better analogy is the one that Stamper used. They discuss it as a continuum or a line. And if they say along that continuum, there's a borderline. It's a threshold. Once you reach that threshold, once you cross across it, that then you're in the realm of an insane mental state. And they never talk about what the means or the cause that leads you to that mental state that reaches that standard. The means are off the table. It's talking about the importance of having a settled, a consistent, fixed standard for determining whether the disturbance of someone's mind is sufficiently serious that person should not be held responsible for their actions. And the thing is about this is that obviously involuntary intoxication and insanity use the exact same standard. Their only difference is it's the means by which one by which one's mind is disturbed. So it actually is a completely different discussion than the one that is brought up in Stamper, where they're talking about that fixed, stable standard. I would note also in response to your inquiry, Your Honor, that courts in Virginia have found that evidence of serious mental illness is admissible when it relates to a fact and issue. That happened in Pritchett versus Commonwealth. In Pritchett versus Commonwealth, the issue was whether the defendant could introduce testimony establishing his serious mental illness for the purposes of determining the reliability of his confession. The court found that it was admissible. If there were a strict reading of Stamper, the narrow reading, if that was truly appropriate, then that evidence should have been admissible, because Pritchett was not alleging that he was insane. In addition, there's been language to that effect.
What I'm asking about is the fact that the insanity would negate the mens rea, or isn't your argument that the involuntary intoxication here would negate the mens rea of Mr. Schmuel?
That's correct.
So yes. Why wouldn't the test of Stamper, and as in Johnson, where it talks about involuntary intoxication, there's a good bit of dicta in that decision too, but in that case, in Johnson back in 1923, I think the conviction was affirmed, right? But why isn't Stamper essentially saying, because it doesn't even cite to Johnson, a previous Supreme Court case, if it thinks it's relevant, why wouldn't Stamper essentially be saying, okay, if you want to negate mens rea, you've got to put on evidence of insanity?
I'm not sure I understand the court's question.
Why didn't the Supreme Court's decision in Stamper essentially set a rule based on the McNaughton history, Virginia always being a McNaughton state anyway? Why didn't it set a rule that if you want to negate mens rea, if you're going to show that the defendant did not have the proper mens rea, that you've got to show insanity?
Your Honor, I think that the reasons it wouldn't have mentioned that, one is that that was not the issue before the court. The question presented before the court was whether Stamper was permitted to introduce mental state testimony in support of an admitted capacity defense. They were talking only about whether there is a lesser mental state than insanity that can be considered. And then when they use the term insanity, you can see that it's used in a relatively loose fashion. There's there's language in Stamper that talks about, for the purposes of determining criminal culpability, a perpetrator is either legally insane or sane. Well, that's not actually completely an accurate statement of law, because for the purposes, if we're dealing with a narrow reading of insanity, the word insanity, because the fact of the matter is, for purposes of determining criminal culpability, a perpetrator could be legally insane, sane, involuntarily intoxicated, unconscious. So when they're using the word insane, obviously they're not using it in a manner to exclude all the possibilities of affirmative defenses that would implicate mental.
Right after what you just quoted to me, the court said there is no sliding scale of insanity.
That's correct. It does say that. But also in early case law, and this is where, frankly, it gets rather confusing, Honesty versus Commonwealth, 81 Virginia 283, talks about if the prisoner relies on the defense of insanity, whether from intoxication or any other cause, he must prove it to the satisfaction of the jury. And then later on, intoxication is discussed as a separate defense from insanity that employs the same standard. So when they're talking about insanity and Stamper, believe it, what they're talking about is an insanity standard, which is monotony. They're using those terms synonymously. They're not talking about a statutory insanity defense. Because if they are talking about a statutory insanity defense, then essentially they're also holding that all these other affirmative defenses have no application in Virginia, and you wouldn't be able to introduce evidence in support of them either. I believe I'm down to 5 minutes, so.
Ms. Adelphia, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Take your time.
Thank you.
You have 15 minutes.
May it please the Court, good morning. Catherine Adelphio on behalf of the Commonwealth. I'd like to make clear what this case is about. Shmuel sought to rely on mental health evidence while precluding the Commonwealth from the information and the access it needed to rebut this evidence. In his reply brief, Shmuel suggests that he was willing to be examined by an expert of the Commonwealth. That was true initially. That is what he said in his November 2015 filing with the court, which was in response to the motion to compel, and he stated that he was willing to submit to the procedures articulated in the insanity statutes. However, less than a month later, on December 14, 2015, Shmuel filed a memorandum in law wherein he refused to be evaluated by a mental health evaluator hired by the Commonwealth. The overarching theme of the Commonwealth's argument today is that the trial court was correct that it would have been unfair to permit the defendant to rely on mental health evidence while denying the Commonwealth the tools it needed to rebut this testimony. Both of Shmuel's purported defenses of involuntary intoxication and unconsciousness relied on expert testimony that stated that the defendant was in a state of delirium. Shmuel proffered many factors that contributed to this diagnosis, but the key to this appeal is where Shmuel suggested to the trial court that he needed to have a forensic evaluation by a mental health expert, namely Dr. Ryan, to rule out differential diagnoses. The proffer was that Dr. Ryan had to rule out both psychiatric issues and the possibility that the defendant was malingering. Malingering is feigning illness. And where this particular defendant could not keep straight how he came to injure his back, whether he could remember nothing of the pertinent dates between November 7th and November 9th, 2014, or whether he could remember that he took his medication perfectly, whether he recalled only watching Harry Potter in front of the fire with his wife, or whether he didn't remember staking out the victim's homes, whether during pertinent periods of time he was totally bedridden or able to play kickball and go on walks, and that's during the summer of 2014. I could go on regarding all of the defendant's contradictory statements, particularly that he served in the Middle East, and that is how his PTSD was caused. I would suggest that it was eminently reasonable that the Commonwealth was entitled to conduct its own mental health evaluation, its own evaluation of the defendant and interview him personally, or not personally, but have its own expert interview him. This is not an unreasonable proposition, and in fact, in other areas of the law, we see that courts have codified similar rules. For example, Virginia Supreme Court Rule 4:10 states that if you're going to put your mental or physical condition at issue, the opposing party is entitled to evaluate it as well. I point to Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 12.2, that provides that a defendant must put the government on notice that it intends to make an argument bearing on whether his mental condition affected his guilt. And I'd suggest that while the Virginia Code does not have similar codifications, that the trial court had inherent authority to require this sort of discovery of the defendant. And I'd like to discuss some of the cases that were cited by the defendant on brief. Shiflett, which was a...
Can you talk first about Johnson, the Supreme Court decision in Johnson, where he relies on the involuntary intoxication there and says that is an exception that can negate mens rea, essentially.
Well, Your Honor, I'd suggest that here, where the involuntary intoxication, that argument is predicated on the delirium diagnoses, and that's basically the basis for his involuntary intoxication argument, that Johnson is not applicable because he's putting his mental health at, it's the foundational basis for his involuntary intoxication defense.
So is your argument that if he's going to put that forward, he has to submit to the examination and allow the Commonwealth to look at the report that his expert did?
Yes, Your Honor.
Otherwise, you can't argue Johnson involuntary intoxication or insanity or any of that.
If a portion of your argument relies on any sort of mental health testimony. So if he was only relying on a toxicologist's report with respect to the chemical nature of or the chemical effects of alcohol or drugs on his system, I think that would have been appropriate. But he specifically told the trial court, I need to rely on mental health testimony to make this argument. And I think that the 1981 case, Shiflett versus Commonwealth, which was decided by the Virginia Supreme Court the year before Code Section 19.2-168.1 was enacted, is especially relevant. Because in that case, the Virginia Supreme Court said the trial court had inherent authority to direct the to direct the defendant to submit to an evaluation by a committee. And as before, we have the Code Section 19.2-168.1's codification of that the requirement that a defendant submit to an evaluation. And in this, and it also predates Stamper, which was 1985. And so I think that in this case, where the court noted that Shmuel wished to rely on mental health testimony, that expert testimony, that would have ruled out malingering and ruled out other differential diagnoses, that it was appropriate for the court to say that if that's the type of testimony that you're relying on and that is what you're basing your affirmative defense on, it was appropriate for the trial court to say that you need to submit to an evaluation by the Commonwealth, and you are precluded from putting forth that evidence.
So is it your thought then that, I mean, is your argument that Johnson might have been applicable before that statute was enacted, or?
Your Honor, I have to admit, I'm not recalling the exact parameters of Johnson, but I believe in Johnson it was not.
Involuntary intoxication.
I don't believe that the, in that case, the defendant's specific mental health and his mental history related to, they weren't trying to put forth mental health evidence. And if they were, the Commonwealth wasn't challenging their reliance on mental health evidence that they did not have the ability to rebut, which is what happened in this case. The Commonwealth did not have the opportunity to conduct its own evaluation such that it could rebut the testimony of the defendant's mental health expert. I'd also like to point the court to the Greenfield case, which was a 1974 case decided by the Virginia Supreme Court. And the issue there was not whether the defendant could present unrebutted medical health testimony. The issue, and this was an unconsciousness case, the issue was whether the psychiatrist in that case could state in detail the hearsay evidence it relied on for its opinion that the defendant was unconscious at the time of the murder. This case does not deal with the issues that are before the court today. I'd note that Greenfield was a pre 168.1 case. And frankly, this case, it's not clear from the text of that case whether Dr. Locke, the psychiatric expert, was an expert hired by the defendant or whether it was part of this committee that was contemplated by the mental health committee that was contemplated by the code at that time. The mental health evaluation rubric has evolved essentially over the last 50 years. And I'd just like to address briefly the case cited by the appellant during his argument. Pritchett addressed whether or not mental health testimony was admissible for purposes of determining the reliability of a confession. And Virginia courts have found repeatedly that mental health testimony related to things other than guilt is admissible. So it's admissible in Pritchett for determining the reliability of the confession. It's admissible in, I'm sorry, court's indulgence. With respect to duress, but it's not relevant to whether or not a defendant acted in self-defense, and it's not relevant to show whether the defendant had the requisite intent to to be found guilty of the crime.
Because those bear directly on criminal responsibility.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, would you like to address your harmless error point?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd suggest that in this case, there was ample evidence. Well, the defendant presented ample evidence that he had some sort of... I'd suggest that the... There's two parts of my argument. One, the defendant had the ability to present ample evidence touching on some of the same things that he argues he was precluded from presenting. But more importantly, there was ample evidence that this particular defendant knew exactly what he was doing, that he knew right from wrong, that he was not acting under any sort of... that he was thinking clear-headedly.
Arguably until he took the handful of tizanidine.
That is correct, Your Honor. And the defendant's own expert testimony by Dr. Ryan stated that the muscle relaxant exacerbated the other symptoms of all of the opiates that he was taking. And so I'd suggest to the court that given that Shmuel had the state of mind to collect his belongings, to collect all the pieces of the taser that he had expelled on the floor, to pour gasoline on the floor. I'd suggest to the court that these are all indicia that he knew right from wrong, and he was trying to cover his tracks, and he had a consciousness of guilt. And I'd suggest to the court that all of the indicia of insanity that the defendant points to, such as, you know, his belief that there were snipers and that he was part of the Knights Templar were involved. I'd suggest that those things were merely part of his effort to both intimidate and confuse the victims, and also to deflect attention from himself. He needed a cover story to explain why he needed all of this information. And frankly, it might not have been the best plan, but having a poor plan does not mean that you don't know right from wrong, does not mean that you don't know, that you don't have an awareness of the nature and character of the actions. And so for those reasons, I'd suggest to the court that it was harmless error, and all the indicia of delirium that the defendant experienced at the hospital after the fact that he points to as this evidence that he was coming in and out of sanity, he talks about periods of languor versus hyper attention, but all that evidence of the languidity and the his sleepiness and his confusion came about after he swallowed the handful of muscle relaxants, which, as Dr. Ryan admitted, is not a handful of muscle relaxants is not a prescribed dosage. So most likely he took all those to keep the edge off after he had been arrested by the police. Oh, and to the extent that he suggests that he was... Sorry, this is just something that I wanted to point out to the court. To the extent that he suggests that he was wearing Velcro shoes because he could not tie his own shoes, like that's the conclusion we're supposed to draw from that, I suggest that the reason he was wearing Velcro shoes is because he wanted to be able to take them off quickly so he could douse the evidence and the clothing that he was wearing at the house quickly with ammonia, just as he did all of his clothes that he was wearing. It wasn't because he couldn't be trusted to tie his own shoes. It was because he had a plan to hide his guilt, and that was to eliminate all the evidence quickly and effectively before he was caught. Unless the court has any other questions, I'd ask that you affirm the decision of the trial court. Thank you.
Mr. Haywood?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can you address harmless error?
I can. First of all, with respect to what the Commonwealth was last discussing, the logic, reason, planning that was involved, there was somebody who was present that night who was not insane, and that was Andrew Schmuel's wife, Alicia. When we look at the planning evidence that was presented by the Commonwealth, all of it related directly to her. The only direct evidence of planning related to her.
But the list of items was in his handwriting, wasn't it? The list of items to be purchased for the purpose of this event?
I think the list may have been all of it. Beyond that, the surveillance videos, the receipts, the motive, all of it was, had Alicia Schmuel's fingerprints all over it, literally and figuratively. The only forensic evidence that was found were the items that were actually in the home, items found to have DNA on them, Mr. Schmuel's DNA on them, were the items that were in the home, and some of the items that were in the home, the direct assault items, and then a bunch that were never used, that were never actually connected to the assault, that were in a bag. Beyond that, if we look at the other facts about how Mr. Schmuel's brain was working, he claimed to be from the Virginia SEC, an agency that doesn't exist. He claimed that he was there because of a murder-for-hire plot that the victim had out on him. A hit that was ordered on him. Later, he claimed that the victim was the one who had ordered the hit. Claimed that order came from the Knights Templar, a Mexican drug cartel.
I guess he could claim a lot of things, but I guess what I'm interested in on the harmless error aspect of this analysis is he's leaving after he's stabbed both of them numerous times, and when he's leaving, he actually kicks the husband in the head and says, "You're going to die now," and then douses gasoline on the rug in the foyer and goes out the front door. But about the time that she hits just after she hits the panic alarm. So if he says, "You're going to die now," doesn't that indicate he knows what he's doing?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. I think the court has to look at all the facts. You have somebody whose mind was deeply disturbed.
Light most favorable to Commonwealth, reasonable inference from that statement.
I don't believe that would show that Mr. Schmuel was acting rationally or understood the consequences of his actions. I think that when you consider all of the evidence together, you have him midway through this incident, maybe an hour or 2 hours past the point when the victims recognized him, still claiming that he's somebody else and seeing snipers out the window. This is bizarre. This was a residential neighborhood in McLean, Virginia. He was taking instruction the entire time from his boss, that was allegedly his wife at the time. Calls after calls, 10, 12 maybe of them. And all of this...
So can't we interpret that as he doesn't want to acknowledge that it's his wife to the victims?
I think that it's actually more consistent with the diagnosis of delirium.
But that's an argument for the fact finder, not to us, isn't it?
I think that we weren't permitted to introduce those facts. So it may be, but we weren't permitted to introduce those facts, and that's where the harmless error analysis comes
in. But you were permitted to introduce evidence of what effect his medication would have on his behavior.
We were in a very strictly limited way, in a way that essentially chopped the head off of the defense. We weren't allowed to use the words that are ordinarily used by people in the field of psychiatry or psychology to refer to conditions that cause legal insanity. We were allowed to sometimes paraphrase them, but that's no more permissible than it would be permissible for a court to make a psychiatrist paraphrase a term like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder in a statutory insanity defense. In essence, what it sounded like to the jury was we were listing a bunch of side effects, almost like the end of a pharmaceutical advertisement. Your Honor, with respect to the point you made about the tazanodone, I also just want to mention this. There was testimony from the medical professionals, I mean, a number of them, at least one of them, but I think it was more than one of them. There were multiple doses of Narcan that were administered to Mr. Schmuel at the hospital. it was testified to that tizanidine, Narcan has no effect on tizanidine. So if all of his languor, his frankly delirium at that point, as mentioned in the medical records, if all that was as a result of tizanidine, then the Narcan would have had no effect on him. But as soon as he was administered Narcan, he woke up, he started yelling expletives, he wondered where the heck he was. And it was evidence of the fact that he was experiencing a toxic overdose of fentanyl and polypharmacy.
And you had victims that testified that during the course of this home invasion and the events that took place thereafter, that he was not lethargic, that he didn't stumble about, that he spoke with a clear voice, that he didn't show any signs of any altered mental state.
Well, he definitely did. He showed signs of delusions and hallucinations.
But you had victims testify.
More pointedly is that the waxing and waning course is perhaps the hallmark of delirium. You have periods.
But they didn't testify about any waxing periods, just that they weren't there.
There was hyperactivity in the house, and there was hypoactivity in the car chasing in the hospital. So that was a distinct change from someone who was very aggressive, moving very quickly, someone moving very very slowly. And that is distinctive. It's actually one of the foremost conditions you'll notice with delirium.
And would also be consistent with someone who over-medicates himself after the event.
We were entitled to present our evidence in support of our defense. It was very highly consistent. It was perfectly consistent with our defense. We weren't permitted to present that defense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time's up, counsel. We'll come down and greet counsel, and then we'll take up Herbert versus Joubert.